Ciao.
Buongiorno.
Buonasera.
I forgot the rest of the pleasantries.
Yeah, well, buonasera is you know, good evening and nighttime and stuff.
It's like after like 7 or something is when they use that one, sundown.
I don't know. I wasn't there that long.
You were there for a while.
Enough.
I guess if you mix it with your trip to Angerland.
Yeah. Oh man, Slovenia was very interesting and a lot of fun. I liked it.
I almost believed when you said that.
Yeah. No. I honestly thought it was one of the more interesting places that we went to. It was also less crowded with tourists in the areas that we were in, so it was more
especially
enjoyable.
If your next visit was Venice, which is very touristy.
Yeah. Oh God. No. I hate Venice. Not,
do you really?
No. I guess. How could I put this? I found Venice very frustrating, but there were lots of interesting things in Venice. So you'd be like, oh, wow, that's cool. And then like 5 seconds later, you'd be like, I just want to walk to the other side of this stupid little plaza. Like, get out of my way, people.
Was it the windy streets and the very few options for getting places that was getting to you?
Yeah, it was so confusing. You're just like dropped into a maze. And Google Maps and Apple Maps, the GPS kept bouncing around through walls and stuff. And so it'd be like, so what street am I on?
You mean when you're in a street that's 3 feet wide of brick that goes up 5 stories, you can't get a GPS signal?
Not so much. Yeah. So it was very frustrating in some parts, because then you'd literally go the wrong way for a block or two, and then you'd be like, well, maybe I can cut over. And it's like, well, it's not a grid, so you can't. You gotta go back and then redo that one. Yeah, there were a lot of bridges and stuff and canals.
Yeah, it looked like you guys found some better food in Venice than we did when we were there, although we were only there for one night, two nights maybe, I don't remember.
Yeah, well, Jason was in charge of the dinners and stuff. Lunches, we mostly just like picked out things as we came across them. It was all good stuff, although there was one thing I was not expecting, because I knew there was going to be fried seafood. I was not expecting tiny, tiny little fried shrimp everywhere. So that was something.
I appreciate that you took the opportunity to use Instagram stories for your fried shrimp.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't even all of them. I think I had basically fried shrimp almost every day I was in Venice, because it just happened to either be in the thing that we were ordering, like if Jason wanted to have the frito misto, you know, the mixed fried fish stuff, or one restaurant, it was actually like the amuse-bouche that came out, like, here's your chef's treat, and it's just like, oh, it's little fried shrimp again. Yeah, it was cute, though. They gave it to you in a little paper cone, like it was, you know, popcorn or something. Yeah.
I only had calamari, but I think we were still mostly on like pseudo set menu nonsense from the tours we were on. Not entirely, I guess. It was just from time to time.
You guys
appear to be big fans of like 9-course meals where it's like 2 bites per course.
It depends. We didn't actually do that in Venice, though. The places we went, we'd get like a starter or two, and then an entree or two.
All looked really good. It was just all very strange things.
Yeah, it was. I would say that the Venetian food was probably the most interesting, because like what was it? The monkfish. that was in lots of stuff. And I like monkfish. And it was like in pasta and stuff like that. So it was just like little tiny pieces. And then I was like, oh, okay. So I'll get the grilled monkfish thing. And then it came out and was an entire monkfish. It was a small one. Probably like 14 inches long or something, but, it was still a monkfish, that they had taken all the skin off of and then grilled and then just plopped it down on the plate. And you know, you got that big, weird mouth thing, just kind of like staring at you. So that was cute.
Did you get a napkin to put over its face so it would stop staring at you?
No, it didn't really have a face at that point. Not to get too graphic, but you could see the jaw bone area thing. But yeah, and then Naples was just a trash fire. I feel bad. My family is from the area. The Fimianis and the Cesars. They on both sides of my mom's family. There's some people from Sicily and some people from Naples, and they went to America. Like a lot of people from Sicily and Naples went to America. And it's like, well, why did you leave? And it's like, oh, this place is kind of a dump.
It's a dump now. I don't think it was always a dump.
Yeah, it's not very well taken care of, that's for sure. I went to on a morning constitutional to go check out the Castle Nuovo down by the water. I was like, oh, a medieval castle right on the water? That sounds great. And then I walked over there, and they were using the area around the castle for storing storage containers and various construction equipment for roadworks that were not seemingly in progress. It seemed like there were a lot of half-started projects around the city, if that makes any sense. Not that I would ever accuse anybody of having like a system of kickbacks in that area, but yeah, I can't say I love that. And then the whole thing with the Venice rental car company thing, I always thought that would be a bad idea, but someone was insistent, and so we had the rental car from Hertz. They had moved locations without telling anybody, so we showed up at the location in the rain at the port, and they had moved 200 meters to another port building. So we walked through the port of Naples with the luggage in the rain to the other building, and then it took 45 minutes to do the paperwork to get the rental car, and then another 20 minutes for the guy to bring the car from the storage area to where we were, and then to escort us out of the port of Naples. So that was just wonderful.
Did you get a cool car? I remember when we were there, I don't remember what it was. I think it was a Ford or something, but it was some weird European off-brand that you were incapable of locking the doors when you were in the car. You could only lock them when you had left the vehicle, which I thought was very peculiar.
Oh, that's very strange. Yeah. No, we had... when we landed in Venice and drove to Slovenia, we had a Audi station wagon, an A4 station wagon.
Very nice.
I mean,
comparatively,
it's a ridiculously oversized vehicle, but it was definitely nicer than the Volvo we got in Naples. It was a Volvo V60, which is not a model that has been refreshed, and I want to say maybe 6 years.
It's because it's such a solid vehicle, you don't need to change it.
I don't know about that one. Like, it didn't even have a backup camera or anything. It was very bare bones. The interior.
Oh, you spoiled Americans and your backup cameras.
Well, I'm used to not having a backup camera because I have a 2002 car. But it's also a smaller car. It's quite another thing to back up a station wagon where you have some difficulty seeing out the back of that thing on a tiny Italian street. So that's great. And we found out when we got down to Positano that you didn't have parking at the hotel. The lady who ran it, because it was a bed and breakfast technically, not a hotel, she called the parking people to come pick up the car, and then it was whisked away, and then we had to call them to bring it back, and it was just a process. So because of that, it wasn't convenient to like take it anywhere. It was basically just there the entire time, but that's fine because you can't really drive around Positano. You just walk, because there's stairs everywhere. So many stairs.
That's the nice / bad part about those fun coastal cities down there in the south, is they're all just built on a hill and you can walk a mile straight up to get from one end to the other.
Yeah, and we did that because the bed and breakfast was up high and everything was down low, so multiple times per day we would go up and down the side of the mountain. Got a lot of steps in.
Yeah,
that was, you know, a thing, but
keep them quads tight or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Afterwards, Jason and I talked about it, comparing that to the sort of French Riviera, South of France stuff when we'd gone there on that trip. And we think we prefer that because it's flatter. there's
Positano or Naples?
Both, but to Positano. Positano was nice. It was just so much up and down, and not having access to a vehicle to go do little day trippy things, and being dependent upon the bus system, which was overloaded, to say the least. And did not run frequently enough for the number of tourists that were using the bus system, which is a lot of fun when you're on that death road that kind of is like the PCH but narrower, that runs along the cliff sides. Just imagine being in a bus standing trying not to get motion sick as you're going around all these corners super fast, because don't worry, he beeped. So whoever's on the other side of that corner definitely heard that, and they're not going to come around.
Yeah, they know where they're going. They're fine.
Yeah, I know. It's nerve-wracking. But then it was to the horrible Hilton at the... it was fine. I guess it wasn't horrible. It was a mediocre Hilton at best at the Rome airport in Fiumicino, and then the flight out of there, and that was it. That was just wow. What a summary of 2.5 weeks.
But now you're rested and relaxed and ready to get back to work and do your best.
None of those things are true. how are you, Dan?
I don't have an answer for that. It changes from day to day. I'm thoroughly deep in the weeds. I'm working on 3 different projects at once, and then there's a whole mess of other things occurring.
Yeah.
We can talk more in the post show if you want. I won't sully this delightful podcast about the Matrix with my personal homemade drama.
Up to you. Listeners may have noticed that we had started the Matrix trilogy to have something to record and bank in preparation for the traveling and stuff, but some real life things had come up, and so we were not able to actually do Matrix Revolutions before I left. So we're doing it now.
Stay tuned for the post show if you care. I'll give a little bit of an update.
Yeah, but it's you know, we're getting to it. We're there. We did it.
We're here. We're finally going to conclude the epic saga trilogy about fate and whatever.
This is actually worse than I remember it being, if that makes any sense.
Well, okay, you want to just jump right in?
Yeah, let's roast this pig.
Okay, first of all, I don't think it's even remotely necessary to talk about this movie in terms of like what happens, because so little happens in this movie. It's like they watched the second one and they were like, wow, we made that really complicated. We should really pare it down. And then they're like, okay, we'll have basically 1.5 plot lines and like one major thing that's going to happen, and then we'll just stretch that into 2 hours and 9 minutes. And then they do those things, and you're like, there you go. It's over.
Yeah, there is... This movie is padded by monotonous action. And I say monotonous because it just goes on for exceedingly long periods of time.
This movie is 2 hours and 9 minutes long, and it is an hour and 49 minutes of shoe leather, and then just like a couple scenes of like plot and things happening.
Yeah, because the majority of this is robots shooting at things and machines hitting other things, and then fighting in the rain, Dragon Ball Z style, for forever. And none of this matters to us as the audience, except maybe the Neo and Agent Smith stuff. But a lot of this other stuff, especially Zion, is just like, it's stuff blowing up, and it's like the how can I phrase this adequately? There is an overzealous glee to the amount of things that they could put on the screen at one time for things happening and the scale and scope of the action, and a total neglect of characters at all. We get to see more of Tank's fiance, girlfriend, wife that I can't really remember. I don't even remember her name, unfortunately. She is in the movie more than she was in the previous movie, and she does things, but I ultimately don't care about her because we don't know anything about her other than she likes the other guy.
Yeah, I feel like they felt an obligation to tie up like every character's storyline, which we could have done without. Like the kid who was in love with Neo didn't need to know his story. Tank's lady friend didn't care. I mean, I guess to a certain extent, what's her name, Jada Pinkett, it was useful to have her there. Her grumpy ex-boyfriend or whatever didn't care. Like, you know, even the Bane guy, like, he was there as a threat at the end of the second movie, and like he did some stuff to sort of like destabilize the defenses for Zion or whatever. But then they're building up to it, and you're like, oh, Smith is in meat space now, and he's going to attack Neo, and it's like, we know it's coming. We know it's coming. He does it, and like, oh, look at that. He killed him. Okay, now what? Move on. Because it wasn't really that consequential.
Well, so that fight was consequential, sort of. And I say sort of because it starts off with some high stakes, and there is no supernatural ability that Neo has in the real world to deal with Agent Smith inhabiting another human being's body. There's no preparation that he has for that and no special skill. Unfortunately, by the end of this fight, he has evolved magical daredevil ability to see without his eyes because they were burned out. So even that consequence becomes meaningless because he has powers to help him in that way.
Well, he can only see the Matrix and Matrix-related things. He can't see, like, real people. Like, he can't see Trinity.
Yes, but that doesn't make any sense. And it's... He didn't need this power. He could have just beat him by other means, or Trinity could have gotten out and saved him, or whatever. Like, the fact that it needed to turn into something where he got the upper hand because he can... see Agent Smith with his fiery sunglasses. Why did we need that? It sort of dissolves the consequences of that. Even the biggest consequence here, when they finally get to the machine city and Neo, you know, goes before baby cockroach face, who was spewing all that stuff, and then he hooks up to the Matrix and he dies, and he crumples Christ pose onto the ground, and then he's evacuated and stuff. It's like that consequence is a big deal, but whatever, I guess. Like, it just sort of just ends with him just being hauled away, and it's like, okay, well, that wasn't satisfying in any particular sense, but there's a consequence. Technically, he's dead.
Yeah. For every action, there's a consequence, as the Frenchman said. But this movie, you know, in the end of the second one, we learned that there is no fate, there is no prophecy or whatever, and what does that leave us with? The movie has to pivot from fate to choice and love as the only things that motivate it. And there's a lot of heavy-handed nonsense about choice, which ostensibly leads us to Neo choosing to sacrifice himself to save Zion, and love, because what wouldn't you do to save somebody that you love? And, you know, Trinity gives her life or whatever to save Neo and get him to the robot world or whatever. But, like, you know, there are parts of this movie when they try to be, I don't know if you felt this way, when they tried to get character-y, I was like, oh God, please go back to the mindless action. Like, when they were doing the, I need to take a ship and I'm going to say goodbye. And it's like, You know, it took me 10 minutes to put my boot on, and I'm very scared. And just like you knew the second you saw me that I was coming with you, it's like, who wrote this? This is terrible. This is so bad. Stop.
That is my favorite part. When she says to him, I saw it on your face. You know you're not coming back from this, and that's why I had to go. It's like, what did you see on Keanu Reeves' face? There's nothing there. He is a block of wood.
Well, compared to who was the Australian guy who ran the ship that they were on? That man can speak without moving any part of his face. It's like that's his gift. Nothing on his face moved.
And it just sounds like he's chewing marbles or something. I don't know.
It's like his lower lip moves and some sounds come out, and that's it.
Yeah, no.
If you would have told me he was like a mocap that went wrong, I would have believed you.
Speaking of,
it was a pleasure. The pleasure is still. It was an honor. The honor is still mine. It's like shaking hands. It's like there's still an hour and 20 minutes left in this movie. Stop doing that.
It is kind of miraculous how much padding of action stuff there is, and these moments of cliched dialogue, and then you look at the time remaining in the movie, and you're just like, how is there an hour left?
Like, it's like every time an action sequence would start, I would just check Twitter because I knew that nothing important was going to happen for the next like 8 minutes.
No, nothing. And the you could say that in the Zion defense stuff that you care whether or not the kid can pull it off, but I don't, because I don't like the kid and I don't care about him, and he's not a character. He's just somebody who admires and believes in Neo as the one, and he has no other like characteriness to him. There's nothing there. So you watch him running around all scared and like living up to the thing that the other guy said to do, and like, you know, get in this thing and make sure that door opens or whatever. And it's like,
I never finished the training program either, kid. And look at me, I'm in charge of everything now.
Yeah, but it's like I don't care about you either.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is a continued exploration of the very interesting, very large world that they built themselves when they came up with this universe of the Matrix. And to a certain extent, you're like, yeah, I will give you that it's kind of interesting to see what a giant scale battle looks like in this world of, you know, the squiddies, and you've got your mech suits and whatever, and your EMPs, and you got to race back in time, and, you know, it's a race against time because they got the drills and they're drilling through the concrete, but then, oh, there's a sub layer that they can go hide underneath where the drill can come through another layer of concrete, which was stupid. But like there's so much action in this movie that the first movie was really trying to be sort of thoughtful about what every piece of the visual that you were looking at meant in terms of story. And then the second one got a little wayward, and then this one, that they're just like, you know what, we're just gonna be a video game for an hour and a half, and then we'll put a little bit of stuff in there, because like, you know, what happens in this? Let's break down literally what we learn about the Matrix universe that is relevant to the plot. We learn that the Oracle is the point counterpoint to the Architect. He created the system, she creates the chaos, and that's their goofy little world that they live in that 99% of the people accept. We learned that the One also somehow has a counterpoint in Smith. So they are, again, when they were talking about the second movie, that they are inexplicably linked, that they are two parts of the same whole thing, and they're going to have to come together and sort their nonsense out. And that's, you know, how they defeats him in the end. But basically we discover that not only did this Neo choose to disobey the Architect, which they knew was going to happen eventually anyway, Smith is so strong in, you know, because he's what, V5 agent, has morphed into something that is taking over so many people in the Matrix that he is threatening the entire ecosystem of the Matrix, just to causing it to collapse and die, and the virus is spreading and he's going to destroy the whole thing. So basically,
and not just the Matrix, but when Neo is talking to Machine Baby Head,
right?
They say, he says to them that they're afraid that he's going to cause damage eventually to the machine city itself and all of the machine denizens.
Yes.
because of how powerful he's become.
Yeah, he's going to infect the programming, and then he's going to infect the robots, and then Smith is going to take over everything. And even, you know, the Oracle has a line where she said he's not going to stop until everything has been destroyed. So apparently what Smith wants is to literally destroy the Matrix and then go destroy all of the machines, which isn't entirely what we've come to understand Smith as in the first and second movie, but fine, whatever. He's drunk with power, and he's chaotic, and he wants to kill everyone, even if that means there is nothing left on Earth, even him. Like, he'll end up killing himself if he destroys Cockroach Babyface or whatever. So,
well, it's not... I want to say this, though. It's not immediately clear to me if destroy means actually break everything, or if destroy means destroy these programs that are there, become the only entity living on the planet Earth, basically. That everything, all the machines everywhere, become Agent Smith connections. That they're all part of the same whole. That he becomes this giant hive mind over the Earth.
It'd be a pretty lonely existence if he was the only one there.
Yeah, well, everyone seems to offend him, so maybe that's the ultimate punishment.
The Matrix 4, Smith has taken over. He's in robot baby head. He sits down on the front steps of the robot library and says, "There's finally time to read." And his glasses fall off and break, and then he cries.
Agent Smith baby crying.
Okay, so him and Neo are point counterpoint eventually, and Smith wants to quote unquote end the war in his way by destroying everything, Matrix and robot world. And Neo wants to end the war where he can say, "Hey, robots, you want to go have your Matrix meat farm and do your thing over there? That's fine. Just leave us Zion people alone, and then free the other people who are part of that 1% that want to be freed, and then we'll live in harmony together, even though you're growing and feasting off of humanity. That's totally cool. We'll just turn a blind eye to that, and we'll be okay having our rave sex parties underground as long as you don't try to kill us and stuff." So that's the deal they strike, and then a bunch of bullshit happens, and then Neo sacrifices himself and lets Smith take him over so the baby head can jack directly into Smith and kill Smith, right?
Basically.
Yeah.
The mechanism that occurs is not entirely clear, but yeah, basically they use... Neo comes to understand from the Oracle and his visions that he needs to go to the Machine City and see this all the way through. And this is an extension of a conversation that Neo had in the second movie with Anthony Zerbe, Counselor Heyman, about the interdependency of machines and humans. And he believes in that interdependency, whereas Smith does not. And so that is part of his arc here, is that he's got to go do this thing. And that's all that happens that we really care about, technically. Carrie Ann Moss is by Neo's side and supports him and does a lot of things, action-y and otherwise.
I said to you in the Slack thing, like the mm-hmm. nothing happened in the first half hour of this movie, and it's because they're like...
Yeah.
We need all of these references that we can come to later. And it's like, "Hey, Neo, remember in that earlier scene in this movie where I was ready to die for you because I love you and I would do anything for you? That's what love is. You make a choice to help and stuff." Like she needed to, like, and then the other, like, the dialogue that was so bad when Merovingian was like, "You would really kill me to give all this up?" And then, what's her name? Monica Bellucci jumps in. "Yes, of course she would. She's in love. Look at her. She's in love. She definitely will kill all of us because she's in love." It's like, shut up. This is terrible writing. It is so heavy-handed. It's like, you needed that whole run-up with the stupid train station thing where he's like, "I'm going to think my way out of this," but it didn't matter because Trinity showed up anyway. And the whole fight scene with the thugs and the club and the Merovingian, just
no.
to have that little bit of a callback later where they're like, "Yes, I would do anything for love."
No. Just
she would do anything for love, and she would do that.
You know, I left that alone because I thought, no, don't do it, Joe. And then you did it. So
you can leave the bad puns to me.
Oh, good. I completely agree. I'm talking about Trinity stuff later in the film when I was saying that she's with him and supports him and stuff. Yeah. But at the beginning of this film, it's a half hour of why is this here? Because if you think that the Merovingian is going to factor into anything happening later, the answer is no.
No, well, he does something off screen. He lets the train man go get Neo, which, like...
But the
whole reason the train station existed was to have yet another heavy-handed metaphor about the programs that were in love and had a baby, and they're willing to sacrifice their program lives to let the baby program life live with the Oracle. Like... How many pivots to love do we need?
It's too convoluted. Oh, love is a word. It's blah blah blah. Oh god, that speech.
What else was just a word? There were two things that were just a word.
I forget. But
I feel like that should be, if I was a machine or a program or a robot, that would be my response to everything. Somebody would say something and I would be like, that's just a word. What does it really mean? And then somebody would get so mad and they would just shoot me in the face.
Yeah. Well, I mean, nobody really appreciates that course of
appreciation is just
argument.
A word, Joe. Mm-hmm. What does appreciation really mean? It's just a feeling.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel appreciation?
No, I can't say that I do. But the thing here with that opening scene that is just baffling is the excessive construction of more world building to accomplish nothing. That everything that's laid down there, it serves no purpose except the daughter Seti. Who goes to be with the Oracle, and that's just so you can have some kid that's in danger, I guess. Like, we would have been fine if she wasn't in the movie.
People love kids, Joe, especially in movies. But, like, what is... I don't want to say what's different from the beginning to the end of the movie, because obviously there's a peace between Zion and the machine world, but who has changed from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie? Like, Neo was always ostensibly willing to sacrifice himself to save people, and... Trinity basically too, like in the second movie, I think they came around to the idea that, you know, if they had to give themselves up or to sacrifice themselves to save humanity and Zion, they would do that. But like, what changed? What, like, why did we watch 2 hours of this? Like, what do we get out of it? Like, oh, sometimes when a man and a woman love each other very much, they're willing to die to save Zion. Like, is that it?
Yep. Except there is a tiny little thing that changed, characters that changed and grew through the thing, and that's the jealousy between Morpheus and Locke has been sorted out. That they're on the same team. Yay. They fixed that. That tension's gone.
Did they really, though? Because, I mean, they were just kind of like, you guys... You don't think ahead, and you've ruined things, and now we've got to move to plan B, and then they were all, like, standing next to each other ready to fight or whatever, but, like, I was still like, ooh, Niobe's cuddling up to Morpheus over there. Locke's not going to be super happy about that, although Locke always has a furrowed brow, so how can you tell when he's angry?
No, he's such an incredibly unlikable character, and I use the word character very loosely, but this movie is very weird because like we've said, it's constructed to have a lot of sound and fury and to signify nothing. And I don't understand why that was the path they chose to take unless they knew they wanted these visuals, but didn't know how to actually put together the story of how the visuals would come to be. And so you wind up with this thing where it's like, yeah, and then they have all these robot suits and they fight all the squids, and it's like, but okay, what are the characters? I don't know. Shrug.
Yeah, here's what this movie is. They originally wanted to make the sequel a single movie, the 2 and 3 together, and again, you could cut Matrix 3 down into a solid 25-30 minutes of story, but you stick that on the end of Matrix 2 And then you've got a 2-hour, 40-minute movie, and that doesn't really sell with people who want to go see this thing. So then you look like, all right, can you cut Matrix 2 down to an hour and a half? And you totally can. But then people who are in love with all of these crazy world-building concepts are like, but can't we just keep some of the cool stuff about all of the world and stuff? And they're like, fine, we'll let you keep the cool stuff, but that means we have to push the ending off into a third movie, and then in that third movie, we might have to stretch a little bit because you want some cool visuals, and we want to see what this thing that we've sort of been, you know, hinting at what it could potentially look like, and show some of the cool, like, epic battle junk in this sort of steampunk future world thing. And it's like, all right, if you do that, this, you know, you kind of front-loaded everything into the second movie, and the third movie is going to be pretty weak, and then here we are, and basically nothing surprising in this movie happens. And well, then
that's not true. There are surprises to be had, but they're not satisfactory, because it's not like, oh, that was interesting. It's like, wait, why did that happen? Like, that's a different form of surprise.
Right. But, I guess in terms of, like, you see where it's going and they go, oh, look, I've subverted your expectation. We're going over in this pleasurable direction. There aren't a ton of things where you're like, I see how you led me down a false path here, and then you tricked me, and then we did another really cool thing instead. There aren't really those things in this movie.
No. None of that. I mean, there are, like, the interaction with Bane and Neo wasn't entirely clear where that was going to go. Obviously, Neo was not going to die in that conflict, but it seemed like
first
the stakes
of all,
were sufficiently high.
I feel like it is worth repeating that anytime the audience knows something that the characters on screen don't, it is usually a very frustrating scene. And in this instance, we have known since the last movie, and he's talking like Smith. He's acting like Smith. He's saying Smith things. And the whole time we're just like, when is Neo going to realize that it's Smith? And they cut back and forth like 8 times. And I'm like, is this the shot where Neo's going to go, Smith? And it's not. You got to wait for like 5-10 more minutes before he's like, how many times does he have to call you Mr. Anderson before you go like, wait a minute, it's Smith? Like, are you really just like, once you log off the Matrix, like, you know, you put your work mind in your briefcase and you leave it at the door, and then you're in home world where you don't even like think about the things that occur in the Matrix. Like, it was so frustrating. It's like, dude, we know that that's Smith. We know you're going to realize that Smith at some point. Let's get on with it. What are you doing?
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with you on that. That's frustrating. But I like the actor Ian Bliss's impersonation of Hugo Weaving, mm-hmm. although he does get a little more Rod Serling than Hugo Weaving in a couple points, but he's Mr. Andersoning it up, and that just makes it all the more frustrating that Neo can't put that together, because it's like he's literally talking exactly like him, and he almost looks like him. Too bad. Keanu Reeves just continues to be not the brightest bulb in the box.
Well, he's pretty bright once you jam a 220-volt broken cable into his face. By the way, if you have a spaceship, you got to just have like 220-volt cables laying around on the floor that you can easily break in half and then jam into somebody to electrocute them.
Well, also, it should instantly cauterize and look like bad Halloween makeup.
It was pretty bad, wasn't it? I mean, I don't think it was as bad as the sealed up mouth stuff from the first movie, but it wasn't great.
No, you could just see the appliance where it was up on his face, and it's just like, why
Trinity,
guys?
Help!
Why?
Smith has applied some sort of blindfold to my face, and I can't get it off.
It would have been funnier if instead of blinding him, he just had a latex appliance and some spirit gum. And
yeah, exactly.
He's like, oh, no, spirit gum, I'm allergic.
He squeezed a tube of super glue onto my face and then put a piece of, threw a towel at me. And it's like he was tarred and feathered. Like he sprayed some tar on his eyes and then like threw some feathers at him and then it stuck. And now he was blind and now he's got to use the force.
So frustrating. Why did he have to use the force? So annoying.
Because there's connection.
Yeah.
He even outright asks the Oracle, like, how did I connect into the Matrix without My body being hooked up, and I think we got a satisfactory answer to that.
Nope, we didn't. She didn't elaborate on that at all. As a matter of fact,
how did the people in the real world know to plug him in so when he ejects, he'll eject properly?
When Maggie, the doctor, was looking at Neo's brainwaves, she figured out that she sees patterns like that when people are plugged into the Matrix. And then they theorized that he must still be in the Matrix somewhere, and they had the one guy do a search for him, and he's like, it didn't turn up. And it's like, wait, you could do like a 5-second search for a person?
Yeah, they searched for him in one scene, and then the very next scene, the doctor's like, I've seen patterns like this before. And it's like, I know what you're going to say. He's plugged in. Did the guy in the other room just said that in a different way? What, do you think we're that stupid we need you to say everything twice?
Yes, they do that a lot in this film where they say things twice. I don't know why.
I feel like they shot this movie and it came out to be like 50 minutes long and they're like, okay, let's write some more scenes and we'll figure it out from there. Either that or they shot, like they actually did, they shot 2 and 3 together, and then once they finally figured out where they could cut the end of 2, they were like, oh, there's nothing left. We gotta stretch.
Blah.
Yeah. So, boy, what's cool about this movie? The rain fight was kind of, neat-ish. It actually didn't go on as long and be as self-indulgent as I thought it would. The Zion stuff was just, there was too much Zion.
There's always too much Zion. I feel that way about the second movie as well as this movie. They kept just trying to make Zion happen, and it was not going to happen. No one on Earth, on this planet that we live on, who has seen this movie, cares one lick about anybody who lives inside of Zion. It is entirely populated by people in just weird, raggy clothes who go to a temple, have their orgy dance grinding session to techno music, and then mope around all the rest of the day eating gruel and fueling up ships and working on their impractical robot machine gun things that they have.
And it's almost like they wanted to show these sequences, but they had to intercut to keep the story going, because you've got the Zion story and you've got the Neo story. But there was so much Zion, by the time they switched back to Neo, you're like, oh my god, I totally almost even forgot that Neo was here doing a thing. And then Neo goes on for so long, and you're like, oh right, Zion is still under dramatic attack. And like towards the end, they start intercutting back and forth with a little more speed. But in the beginning of the movie, you're just like... Neo's like, I need a ship. And then, like, you don't see him for, like, a half hour. And they're like, oh, I'm still here. And then I fight Bane. And then, like, you don't see him for another half hour. And it's like, okay, I'm flying to the... It's like, the pacing of this feels so weird. But, like, I don't know. It would have probably been less satisfying for the nerds with the big Matrix universe boner. But, like, if they would have just done the part where Niobe was, like, trying to sneak back, but then, like... alerted a bunch of the Sentinels and like had to run for their life in this like really circuitous path, but they knew that they had to get back to Zion in time to help fight, you know, by midnight or whatever, because they had that stupid ticking clock. And then if they're like,
it turns back into a pumpkin,
right? Exactly. Zion turns into a giant concrete pumpkin full of squiddies. But if they had that timeline and they're like, we're just barely gonna make it because we had to take this really weird path because we're being chased this whole time, and then like we never saw Zion the whole time they were running, and they just bust through that gate and they're like, crap, we're like a half hour late and the battle is already going absolutely haywire. And then they get, you know, you could show some of the fighting there and then do your EMP nonsense or whatever. Maybe the EMP was damaged when they crashed through the wall. That's what I was thinking. They're like, you crashed through that gate and smashed all that crap, but your EMP still works? Fine, whatever. But like, there could have been a way to do that with a little bit more of a reveal where it wasn't just like constant, you know, machine gun fire against Sentinels for, God, what, like 50 minutes of this movie is just like, blah, 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 screaming, just, blah. It's like, you can squeeze that trigger as hard as you want. That's not going to make a difference.
No. I mean, I will, the effects in the third movie are better than the effects in the first movie and better than the effects in the second movie.
Yeah, there was a lot of Zion catwalk stuff with black levels that were just like 20% off.
Yeah, it's still better than some of the things we saw in the second movie with like horrible cloth sims and things.
I forgive cloth sims more than I forgive compositing, but you don't.
I mean,
it's compositing. Look at the image right there. It doesn't match. Make it match. Do the thing. Cloth sims, you're like, well, really? That's the best we can do? And it took 50 hours on our render farm? Like, I guess that's what we got.
Okay. I mean, I just... it bothers me more when you see something that looks phonier than it should. And it's part of the creative process. Whereas I feel like the black level thing is a technical error, and it is indeed a technical error, but it's not as bad because it's not as it's not like the concept of that shot was poor.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess it makes sense.
Anyway, I think they did a better job on this movie than they did on the previous ones, despite the fact that there's still unpolished rough edges around all of this, no doubt because of the time constraints that they were under. And the fact that one of the companies went under and the work had to be transferred to other companies. But the amount of work that they did was also enormous for no particularly good reason, as we have discussed. So it's interesting to see all of the swarms of squids and things and think about how challenging that must be to work on, because when you're watching the movie, they don't mean anything. Otherwise, so that's the thing. The split screens for Hugo Weaving are at their best in this movie than they were at the last three.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really get any split screens with Hugo Weaving in the first one, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job because they added like lightning to his face and stuff too, and that all worked pretty well.
Yeah, I mean the final fight mostly just suffers from how long it goes on, but it benefits from the fact that there is only two main people going at it, and that the rest of it can just be the background, like people in the backgrounds of a Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat video game arcade thing. Like they're just there as props. Like they don't do anything.
Like those people in the Cuba level in Street Fighter that are just like leaning up against the Volkswagen in the background.
Yeah, like they're just doing their animation cycles, shuffling back and forth, standing in the rain, getting illuminated by lightning. That's it.
You know, a lot of that was practical. They had people there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was just in the shots when everyone's too far away to see them.
Yeah, but the then, you know, you have the end of this movie.
So I will say that while when I first saw this, actually, I should say when I first saw this, I didn't understand this movie at all. I watched it and I was like, what just happened? Like, whatever. But I wouldn't say that I saw the sacrifice coming, but I wasn't surprised. Like, you know, what is he going to do? Beat one Smith and be like, all right, other Smiths, let's do this. But, you know, like, I think they did a slightly better job in this one of sort of like illustrating a hierarchy of Smiths. Like when he took over Oracle, he kind of like surged with power because you could tell that he was hooked into, you know, he got all of her powers now because he was jacked into all the same stuff that she's jacked into, which is theoretically all of the Matrix, because she's the counterpoint to the Architect, who oversees everything. So theoretically, once he took over the Oracle, that was his quick and easy path to dominating all of the Matrix however he saw fit, and that was, you know, the imminent threat to the robot world or whatever. But you know, then he's like, he takes over Neo and he's like, ah, now I got Neo power, but you're jacked directly into Hover Babyface, and Hover Babyface is like, I got you now, Smith, and then kills Neo. But here's what I want to ask the distinction. If this whole time Smith has just been like chest poking random Matrix people and taking them over, Those people are also jacked into the Matrix. Why didn't the Matrix just burn them out? Do like your standard Matrix pods not have the feature the floating baby head has where it can burn people out?
It's because they weren't the one. Yeah, I know. I'm not saying it makes any sense. I'm just saying that's the only distinguishing feature.
I didn't need that the Oracle was technically Smith's mom. Like, he calls her mom, and it's like, okay, once we did this whole like balancing of the equation thing where the architect builds the order and the Oracle throws the chaos into it to allow humanity to have this Matrix world that they understand and they accept. Like, so basically the Oracle programmed Smith, but did she also program the agents? Because the agents aren't there to be chaotic. The agents are there to instill order. So did she program Smith specifically to be the one who like gets screwed up and eventually gets kicked out of the system and then turns into like virus that can, you know, consume everybody? Like, did she see that he was going to do that if she created him that way?
There is no dialogue to explain one way or the other how she is involved in the creation of Smith. It could be as loose as the fact that she had a hand in the Matrix, so therefore she is the mother of the Matrix, as the architect had said at the end of the last film.
The second movie says he's the father, she's the mother, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that could be the way of looking at that, which is mainly the way that I think about it, because it seems unlikely that she...
That means she's everyone's mother, and the architect is everyone's father.
Mm-hmm. Mother, father. No, but the...
By the way, quick real-time follow-up, Sauce in the chat room says there's 53 minutes of squid attack on Zion.
Oh my god, it's too much.
That is almost exactly half the movie.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of Freedom Istu. But the thing...
Frito Zion. Oh god.
No, but the thing with the Oracle is that she has some dialogue in here where we come to understand that she is actually playing a game within this game, where she is gambling that by involving herself in this manner and accelerating this process, that she will cause a scenario where Neo can sacrifice himself, and then that somehow results in the peace between humans and machines. That is her gamble, apparently.
Yeah, because... and also, isn't it such that she's there to throw chaos, but she threw a little too much chaos in creating this Neo that off-screen the architect or somebody got mad and banished her, and she snuck her way back in a different body? Like, I really don't like the way they retconned the replacing of the actress. That was not necessary at all.
No, they could have done what a lot of other movies do and just...
Yeah, not mention it is what you do.
Yeah. Just continue from there. But they tried to do like the, you know, Doctor Who route of like, oh, I regenerated and this is my new Oracle mm-hmm. body.
I hope she learned her lesson. Isn't that what the Merovingian said? It's like, what?
Yeah. It's not clear, but he brings it up apparently in an act of vengeance between the last movie and this movie. He somehow did something to harm her and cause her to lose the physical appearance that she had, as retribution for the theft of the Keymaster. But it doesn't matter what it is. It wouldn't have been in this movie had Gloria Foster not unfortunately passed on. Like, that would have not even featured into the plot of this. So it is obviously just there because they felt very self-conscious about explaining the cosmetic and acting differences between these two actresses. And the Merovingian also has the unfortunate task of starting up this movie with that total weirdness, and relaying the information about how he wants the Oracle's eyes, because they're super powerful, and that's supposed to somehow give us information about the fact that it would be whoever possesses them would have a lot of power, basically. And that's unnecessary because we know that the Oracle is powerful. We could have done completely without that. They could have just had the Oracle and Smith interacting in the way that they do when he takes her over at the towards the middle ish of this film.
The other Smiths getting scared that the new one appears crazy and powerful, like that explained itself. But again, you also had the Merovision, and when he said like, "Bring me the Oracle's eyes," I mean, I was like, "Do you mean it's as some sort of like murderous like flesh prize for like getting retribution for what she did? Like, do you literally want them to kill her and like cut her eyeballs out? Like, what are you saying? Her eyes?"
Yeah, it's dumb. Like, I think they wanted to imply that. They wanted to talk about her powers and how he wanted to acquire them, but it didn't need to happen because it's completely obvious from the interaction that Smith has with her what happens if you take over the Oracle. So I don't understand. But that seemingly is there because they want to make that connection. It's just a mistake, I think, to even bother. And the Oracle, I don't know why she endangers Sati the way that she did, because she could tell that Smith was coming and then like waits to like 2 seconds to less 2 seconds to let her go. But I guess maybe she knew that there was no escaping at this point, but for some reason she asks him what he did with her and like, oh no, and all this stuff. And it's like, if she knows things, why does she ask these questions? It's odd because we know that she knows that Smith wants to gain access to her and then use her power against not only Neo but the rest of the Matrix. And she allows for that to happen in order to facilitate the events that come about at the end of the film. And the architect says as much, that, you know, it was a big risk that she took and all this other stuff when they're sitting on their park bench with their horrible sunset.
That the girl created somehow, by the way. Why does the girl have the power to create sunsets?
Well, her mother was an interactive program thing.
And her father ran the power grid. So obviously when you put those two together, it equals sunset designer.
Well, he ran the recycling systems at the power grid. I want you to think about that. Remember what they recycled at the power plant?
People. No. Oh, okay. Yeah. Got that. I was thinking of the Matrix World power plant.
Yeah, well,
the one that they blew up. Not in real world.
Oh.
Yeah, remember the one they blew up in the second movie? Anyway, but that's
interesting. They didn't. Yeah, they didn't live in the Matrix, though. I don't know. It's confusing.
So is this like one of those things where like a father and mother like work really hard hours, like 16-hour days, like really horrible factory jobs to make a better life for their kid, and then their kid is a giant disappointment by going to art school?
I think that was the implication, except for the disappointment because of the art school thing. I think you're projecting.
No, I'm just saying. what is her marketable skill in the marketplace there? She can make the sky pretty.
Yeah,
and
well,
presumably,
I mean,
slightly less pretty.
it was hideous, really. But it's weird how it concludes with the resetting of the Matrix, and we even get a callback to the stupid cat thing, where everyone is just all better now. Except, of course, for the principal actors who we know are outside of the Matrix. But for some reason, it resets, and the architect is talking to the Oracle, and they're sitting on a park bench enjoying this hideous sunset, and it's all better now. And it's like, what? Why? Why is it all better now? What did we resolve? Couldn't the machines just kill all the humans anyways? Like, way.
Now that they got what they wanted and Smith is gone, like, literally what is stopping them from just killing all the humans? There's, like, is there, like, honor amongst machines? Like, what's the point? Why?
Yeah, because there's no the one anymore either. Or even, like, a runner-up to be the one.
Well, theoretically, if they rebooted the Matrix, there will be another one, won't there? There just also happens to be a couple thousand people in Zion who didn't die this time, so the human city can get bigger.
I guess.
Yeah, I guess this is what I'm saying. Like, what's different now than the beginning of the movie, other than, like, the robots aren't trying to kill the people, but the people are still in the same place. The Matrix is still in the same place. It's just Neo and Trinity are dead.
Yeah. And apparently the only reason why they aren't killing the humans is because they just had their little chit-chat, and that's it. I don't understand.
I feel like you should have got something in writing that sort of laid out the terms, like peace for, you know, Morpheus, or no, who says, who says the peace will last as long as it can?
I can't remember.
It doesn't even matter. Oh, the Oracle, when talking to the architect, it says, how long do you think it's going to last? As long as it can. Mm. So what does that mean? Like, is at some point the big baby head robot going to be like, all right, I gave you 50 years of peace. Now we're done. I'm going to kill you now.
Or the humans are like, screw you guys. Because I don't know if you've met humans, but we do that from time to time.
I imagine they might push their boundaries and be like, maybe we can have a city on up above, like, where there's, well, I guess there it's cold and there's no sunlight,
the,
right?
The so surface, the surface is worse.
Well, unless they go above the clouds where there's a beautiful sun.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why we needed that, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, also, like, again, they really should have fleshed out these terms and at least, you know, send an email back and forth so you have some sort of record. Like, does this mean, like, all right, you humans, no more jacking into the Matrix and screwing around and stuff. Just, like, you guys stay in Zion and we'll stay over here and do our thing. Like, is the machine world going to consider a breach of contract if, like, somebody hops into the Matrix and goes and pokes around in their trench coat and sunglasses?
Unclear. I mean, because the movie doesn't address the issues. It's just like, and then the bad guy was destroyed, and peace reigned. The end. That is the ending of this film.
Neo ended the war.
Mm-hmm.
He lost the battle, but he won the war. I'm surprised nobody said that. The stupid line that somebody could have said.
Well, let's not give them any ideas. At some point, they might George Lucas the whole thing. And then, fix stuff.
I feel like there is a solid, I don't know, it's probably a 2-hour, 20-minute version where you combine the second movie and the third movie.
That's probably true. I mean, I just won't. But you can do that. You can make your Phantom edit.
Yeah, I'll get right on that. It's very lucrative business, Phantom edits.
Yes, yes. You're just showered with praise and wealth.
I bet I could get a fair amount of retweets if I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Put in a good couple of months of work on re-editing a feature film and then get a couple of retweets.
That'd be nice. It'd be very rewarding.
Yeah, I might even get like a Slashdot link or something. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, if you're lucky, other websites will take your video and embed it using their own players so you can't get stats.
I'll get,
they can sell ads against it.
What does Facebook call it? Freebooting or whatever?
Yeah, whatever. I don't pay attention to that. But
take away my income streams, man, by re-embedding my video instead of sending people to my thing.
Yep, that's the horrible world we live in now.
Yeah.
Machines wouldn't do that. They'd keep their word.
Yeah, for sure. Because, what do you think they are, human?
Yeah, they just send 301 redirects, so you'd be fine.
Is there anything else in this movie to, like, talk about at all?
I don't think so. I mean, there was a ridiculous opening sequence where, in order to top the green text of the first two films, where the first one is just a wall of green characters and stuff that resolves into the dialing app thing, and the Matrix titles. And the second one is that clock, that stupid clock, where it's like texture composed of the Matrix characters at various sizes and scales. The third one starts off with an entire city, city blocks, just built skyscrapers spanning way off into the horizon. And it's all Matrix characters, and then it pulls out and it reveals that the entire city was really just one character, and then it flicks over to another character, and then we get the title for the film.
It also does like a weird like pulsing thing, like I don't know, like you've seen visualization of like blood flow or something, where it's just sort of like in out real quick or something. Makes no sense.
It's unnecessary.
For a minute when I hit play and it started doing like the code and the zooming in, I was like, did I press play on the second movie instead of the third one again? Oh no, Rose. Okay, there you go. Revolutions. All right, now what are we doing? 3D stupid things. Okay, here we go.
Yeah. One final question for you. This movie is Matrix Revolutions, plural. What are the plural revolutions that have occurred?
Oh God, I feel like this is like a speech and debate question or something. War ended. It's not really a revolution though, because a revolution would be a starting of a war, I think, more so than the ending of a war. Nothing. Maybe they mean revolutions, like the world keeps on turning, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed something on the Wikipedia page that the babyface thing, the babyface sea anemone, it's Deus Ex Machina is the character name.
Oh, played by Henry Blasingame
for the motion capture, and the voice is from Kevin Michael Richardson.
Oh. The Mr. Henry Blasingame, he was an actor in this and the Matrix Path of Neo video game.
Great.
That's
good
it
for him.
Yeah, that's a fun last name. Blasingame. It's kind of a Jerry Lewis thing.
Yes, that's exactly where I might want.
Yeah. Jerry Lewis was a robotic babyface sea anemone.
It must have been great to motion capture that.
Kevin Michael Richardson. Oh, look at this guy. He's very friendly looking. There's a TV series for Guardians of the Galaxy.
Apparently.
He plays Groot there.
You okay?
I mean... movie's stupid. Like, literally nothing happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, stuff happens. It's just you don't care about it.
Some things happen. Like, every time they would cut back to a ship, and they'd be like, all right, man, I need my best gunners over here, and I need the things over there, and you switch over there, and I need you to do a 90-degree power turn as we fly through these tubes. I'm like, somebody had to write this, because they're like, we need pages. We need pages of things happening. So write pages of... It could be literally any movie. You're being chased by a thing in a spaceship, and you're going to shoot the things with the spaceship.
Sigh. The end.
It's a letdown. There's nothing there.
Yeah. I think that concludes our Matrix thing.
It's like the filmmakers were so ready to be done with this. They're like, is this okay? Is it kind of like tie up the loose ends? Yeah, sure. Then cool, go with it. It's not very satisfying. I said go with it. Well, the audience might be a little mad. Go with it. We'll be done.
I think the filmmakers are excited about this film. I don't think they were done with it. I think they, unfortunately, were excited about the wrong things. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. If you're into the video game battle stuff, there's a lot of it.
Yeah, another exhibit of that would be Jupiter Ascending.
Oh God, I forgot they did that.
Yeah, so you know that's another thing where just stuff is happening, and you're just like, why is any of this going on?
At least with like Speed Racer, you're like, there's dumb things happening, but it's literally a race. Like, that's literally the point of the thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I have nothing positive to say about Speed Racer. But
have you seen Cloud Atlas?
No. How can I put this? I was not inspired by the reviews of Cloud Atlas to go out and seek it out, especially because I generally don't care for the fare that they have produced. Did you watch it?
No, I did not. I heard a lot of people say bad things about it, and I heard a couple people that I like say good things in a very confusing way, and I was like, really? Like, yeah, it's like 9 intertwined plot lines and story. I'm like, that sounds like a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I just didn't see it.
No, same. Speaking of seeing things, we had initially talked about our plan to do Dark City and the 13th Floor.
Mm-hmm.
Are we gonna follow through on that one, or was that an empty threat?
I mean, we can. We don't have to like continue on the theme. Like, if we wanted to take a breath, we could come back. But we also even got another recommendation for World on a Wire, which I've never heard of, which is also apparently based on whatever book the 13th Floor is based on.
Hmm. Yeah, never heard of that.
Yeah, 13th Floor came out same year as The Matrix, so that's another reason I thought it was a nice parallel. And Dark City was around the same time, too, is that right?
Yeah, I think it was a year or two before.
Hmm. I don't know. I mean, maybe we take a breath next week and then reassess how we feel about AI and is your world real consciousness and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds like a plan.
Oh God, are we done? Are we still in the show? Are we done?
We're done. This is the end. Enjoy the sunset, Dan. Enjoy this beautiful sunset that I made for you.
It's so hot and moist in here.